This is KTOO Public Media's Juno Afternoon, and this is a special edition of the show. We're calling it Huna Afternoon. We're coming to you from the Esther Greenwald Library at Huna City Schools, and we have some very special guests with us on today's show. To my left, we have Mr. G, Gordon Greenwald, master carver, retired school teacher, caretaker of regalia, among other things, and we are indeed in his grandmother's named library, the Esther Greenwald Library. Mr. G, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's so nice to have you here. Gunashchish. Thank you for allowing us to be here. And also we have Frank Wright. He is the president of the board of directors of the Huna Indian Association. He's a fisherman, and he's Duffy's husband, and we'll get to meet Duffy tomorrow. Welcome to the show, Frank Wright.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here, Gunashchish. Thank you for allowing us to be here. And we also have Mary Beth Moss. She is a National Park Service tribal liaison for the Huna Indian Association. Mary Beth Moss, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here. Did I get your introduction right?
Yes, great to be here. I'm a tribal liaison with the National Park Service for Huna Indian Association and also for the Yakutat-Tlingit Tribe in Yakutat and Douglas Indian Association in Juneau as well.
I have a feeling that you all wear several hats, and I probably didn't even get to half of them here in Huna. Well, we are honored to be here from KTOO Public Media in Juneau. And as we're here, we're trying to get to know our neighbors to the west. We have so much to learn. And how you came to be here. And I'd love to start with you, if I may, Frank Wright. Tell us about life in Huna. What do you love about living here?
Well, when I was a kid, it was a lot of fun. You know, we always played out. There was no such thing as a TV. There was no such thing as a phone. And this town used to be, just had two cars. Three, actually. El Cain's oil truck, Ganty's oil truck, and Frank Thomas's...
Frank Schotter's
Model T. You know, and the thing is, we didn't have to take our shoes off because there was no mud. And we always played running around in the woods. And that was one of the things that was our fun time, playing in the woods and running up and down the trails. And then I remember when we were in back of the Dibdahl's house, and they had swings back there, you know, kind of like Tarzan swings. You just swing and just, and even behind the school here, we used to call that. There was a swing there. We used to swing across the river to jump off on the other side. So,
give or take, what years were these?
Oh, gee, I was probably...
He doesn't want you to know.
Gosh, that, when I was in junior high, I guess, I was probably about 13, or I guess 12, 13.
Early 60s?
Yeah.
And we started with you, Frank, because you're indeed the elder, but only by 1 year to Mr. G over here to my left. So you two were schoolmates, is that right?
We were classmates, yes. We went through school together, graduated together, and, we have lots of common history back in those days.
And among other things, Master Carver, retired school teacher, caretaker of regalia. What are you working on right now? What's keeping you busy?
Well, right now I'm leading the carving of a 20-foot totem pole for the city of Huna. And we started it last summer. We'll be working on it through part of this summer. We should finish mid-summer and then move on into the next project, whatever it may be.
So, is that a healing totem?
No, this one is not. This totem that we're doing is trying to tell some of the migratory history of the Huna people leaving Lituya Bay with the Duktaintana and Kluknakudi, and the others from Glacier Bay and ending up here in Hoonah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? About
it's probably a long story.
Starts in time immemorial.
The Raven side of our people that came out of Lituya Bay were washed out with tsunamis, primarily, and then moved on down along the coast. And the Kluknakuti, the Coho people, ended up in Sitka, but the Dak Dane Tan ended up here in Hoonah. And then you have the Eagle side of our people that came out of Glacier Bay with the advancing of the glacier that forced us out of Glacier Bay. And then we kind of, as clans, kind of scattered for many years trying to find a new home prior to settling here in Hoonah. We eventually kind of moved here, and when everybody visits, you see the beauty of Port Frederick and in our setting, and see why we ended up in this place. Though we all yearn for our homelands of Glacier Bay and Lituya Bay, which have its beauty, Port Frederick and Hoonah has its fair share of that also. So,
thank you. Mary Beth Moss, if I may, Mr. G, Gordon Greenwald was just describing what it looks like here. Can you take that a little bit further and paint a scene for our listeners? What does this space look like around us?
Well, I moved here from Gustavus, which is a flat glacial outwash plain with lots and lots of space around you. So coming to Port Frederick for the first time for me was really glorious, because there are mountains that look like they're right close up. Like you can climb them. So Port Frederick is ringed by these just towering mountains, several special mountains to the Hoonah people that are named Elephant Mountain and Ear Mountain, for example, really interesting figures. There are freshwater streams that carry salmon. The beaches are lovely here. There's particularly the beach out at the cannery is just a really wonderful beach to spend time on. There are whales. 2 days ago, there were whales breaching, right? You know, you felt like you could just reach out and touch them. We could smell their breath, actually. The kids were grossed out. It's a place of plenty. And I think the people here are warm and inviting, and it feels like home.
Frank Wright, among other things, I understand that you are a fisherman. Can you tell us a little bit about your life as a fisherman? When did it begin?
Well, it began when I was 11 years old. My dad was running the Patricia May, and then after that, he ran the Mary Joanne, and then the Vagabond Queen, and now I'm running the Vagabond Queen. I go black cotton, I go to halibut, and I go tanner fishing and king crab and purslane and just about everything there is to catch, I guess. So it's an exciting life, you know. I actually decided I wasn't going to be a fisherman. So I went to the University of Hawaii, and I graduated there, and then I just came home, and I worked around here, and my dad asked me to run the boat, so here I am fishing, and I love it.
But you still escape to Hawaii every year.
Yeah. You know, it's you know, when I go out, you know, and I'm off the boat for a while, and I go out, and I'm in a pilot house, and I'm looking, and I see, whoa, this is so cool. You know, I'm going out in the ocean again, and, you know, and feel that ocean swell, and, you know, been a few times, I've gotten a few storms, but, you know, I take care of the boat, so it takes care of me. So it's, you know, it's a life that I like, you know, because it's so much freedom for myself to do pretty much what I want to do, you know. And the only problem we have now is last year was probably the worst salmon season I've ever had in my life. It was terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm hoping that's not part of the climate change that's going on, you know, because there's things out there that, you know, just makes me worry about what's going on and around. So, you know, when I see something that is not right, you know, it makes me pause and wonder what can we do about it, and how can we make things better, you know. So but I love fishing, and here I am. I'm going to be a fisherman until I say I'm going to sell my boat, but that's not going to be for a while.
Before we went on the air, we were all just sort of sitting here talking around the table, and I found that the conversation kept going back to the climate. It seems like the climate is a part of all of your lives. So I would like to come back to that in a moment, but we were just talking about him being a fisherman. You're a carver. How did your life as a carver come to be?
It's a different adventure. I grew up here in Hoonah also, and my father was a fisherman. So I although it was a troller, different than what Frank does, and so I grew up on the ocean also. But I went out to college, never coming back to Hoonah, and here I am, and glad I'm here. I came back as a teacher, and I never even dabbled with the Native arts. My father's side is Native. My mother's non-Native. My grandmother's, again, was a fluent speaker, but always told me never to bother with learning the language. It was time to move on, and I felt that it was her way of protecting us from what they suffered. Not because she was ashamed of it, because she spoke it, like Frank's side of his family. They spoke it, but never wanted us to do it. But anyway, as I came back to teach, I wanted the Native students that I was working with to gain some understanding of their life, who they are. And I didn't know anything about the art. But I, you know, you look in the books and you go, anyone can do this. So, you know, they were going, no, I don't know how to do it. And I go, well, watch, I'll show you. Well, I still have my original carving. No one sees it. No one will see it. But, you know, and so then I realized that in order to teach, I had to know something more about it. And so I started working with others. I had probably 7 or 8 different mentors that shared their knowledge with me. And at the same time, they took the time to teach me. So I must pass it on, or they've wasted their time. So with the knowledge that I was privileged to learn, I started carving more and more, and it's become a way of my life now. Once I retired, and when I'm not out playing in my boat, then I'm working in my shop carving and doing Native artwork, and so that was how I got to where I'm at now. Still working at it, still learning, taking classes when I get an opportunity with someone with some more knowledge than I have. And hoping to keep on passing it on.
Can I write in, Gordon, a little bit?
Please do.
So when the National Park Service began talking about working with folks in Hoonah to build the tribal house, there was a natural fit for who would lead the design and carving of all the cultural elements, and it was obviously Gordon. He had a strong history in the community. He had these strong ties with the kids in the community as well as elders in the community. And so the Park Service approached Gordon. When was that, Gordon? How many?
It's
been 9 years? 2010.
It was in the fall of 2009 that Wayne came to talking to me, yes.
And so so Gordon has worked with a number of other assistant carvers and apprentice carvers to craft the cultural elements that are in the Huna Tribal House now in Glacier Bay. And part of that project, the part that I loved the most, was that the carving shed became this really special place for the community to gather. And kids would come over after school, right? Oh, and just run in the door and hang out. And community members came in to carve. I remember quite a few folks would just come in and sort of ads for a little while or carve for a little while, drink coffee, visit. So even after Gordon retired as a teacher, he was still teaching kids and adults about Northwest Coast design and carving and other crafts.
Well, he worked in in high school too. He was a wood shop person,
right?
So he was around wood all the time. So that's part of it.
Yeah.
So
you've been hearing the voices of Gordon Greenwald and Frank Wright and Mary Beth Moss. We're going to take a short little break, and we will be back with more from Huna Afternoon. Support for today's show comes from Icy Strait Lodge, centrally located in Huna and featuring a variety of rooms and on-site restaurant, car and boat rentals, information at icystrait.com. This is KTL Public Media's Huna Afternoon. We're here in the Esther Greenwald Library at Huna City Schools. We have Gordon Greenwald, Frank Wright, and Mary Beth Moss with us in this segment of the show. Frank, you were just telling us about the importance of elders in your life.
Well, you know, I got involved after I came back from living down in Hawaii, you know, and I start having meetings with elders it was traditional tribal council elders, you know, so, you know, and every time we went, I had a meeting, we would talk about Glacier Bay. And every meeting we talked about, it was Glacier Bay. We'd have other things on our agenda, but it was come back to that, you know. And that they, I really believe that they kept everything alive. You know, if it was never mentioned, where would it have gone? You know, I had a nephew that said, Glacier Bay, what do I have to do with Glacier Bay? You know, but the elders, you know, always spoke about Glacier Bay because they knew that their history wasn't from the bay. And I was so honored to be able to be part of it because, you know, it instilled in me that to keep on pushing, make sure that, you know, that vision never went away. And I'm always odd at some of the elders that are not with us anymore and what they knew in their language and stuff and how they interpreted the bay and how they believed that we should be always. Because when you have an identity, you know, my father is a Chukinini, he's from Glacier Bay. I'm different. I'm Lukunakari from Sitka Kayashkahit over in Sitka. And I think that my father always said, my father was real shy. He didn't like to talk. So I said, Dad, you want me to say something for you? And he said, yeah, please say something for me. And, you know, and so I'd speak on behalf of my dad, but I have to ask permission to do that. So for us to keep things alive, it was because of the elders. You know, if they didn't speak, we would probably not even have a house in Glacier Bay. We probably would not. I don't think we would, because who else would speak? That's why whenever I talk, you know, I'd like to thank, you know, the Park Service and all them, but then I always come back, but we need to thank the elders that spoke on Glacier Bay all the time. You know, so it's very important we keep them alive too. If we don't keep them alive, we have to keep them alive. You know, we always talk about, well, an elder passes away, but we think of them. But here we are talking about the elders that of Glacier, that Glacier Bay, and we are still keeping them alive to be part of our existence as part of our tribe. We have to keep doing it, or else what would be their, how do you say, their legacy? You know, they have to be, you know, I think of elders that lived next door, you know, Leonard Davis and Jim Young and Kelly Sinclair and J.G. Pratt and Tootsie and all them that lived down the street, you know, and Mamie Williams' husband, you know, and, you know, it's important. I have to tell them, goodness sheesh, for keeping things alive. Goodness sheesh.
Goodness sheesh. Thank you for sharing that with us. Mary Beth Moss, I'm thinking about some of our listeners in Juneau who maybe don't know what Huna Shuka Heat is. Can you describe the scope of that for us?
Well, it's a dream come true, I think, right? For the people of Huna and for the Park Service. It's a tribal house that stands on the shores of what is now Bartlett Cove, but for the Huna people was home since time immemorial. It's a place that the original village site was Tleausha Shakyan and then Gatini after the Little Ice Age. So the tribal house, or Huna Shukahit, was a building that was planned and developed and built collaboratively from step one. It was designed collaboratively, it was planned for collaboratively, it was built collaboratively, and it's operated and managed now collaboratively. So even as we speak, there are Huna Indian Association interpreters over in Glacier Bay that will be working at the tribal house this summer alongside National Park Service interpreters, and we've been able to hire local people here to help with managing the facility. And I think it's pride and joy for all of us. Isn't it? People talk about the day of the dedication and the feeling of the walls vibrating when the kids came in, the Huna kids came in drumming, and the walls just vibrated with this drum beat that really brought life to the tribal house, to Huna Shuka Heat. So,
Gordon Greenwald, how do you feel right now speaking about Huna Shuka Heat?
Well, I mean... for me, it was such a privilege. You know, there are many other carvers out there that are much more renowned than I, and they'll never have the opportunity that I had to do this. I was given all the latitude by the National Park Service, as well as my elders, to come up with the designs. I had to often sit and listen with elders to talk about some of their oral history before I could design. But I didn't have to take any of my designs to them and say, is this good? Is this approvable? They just said, okay, you know it. Go do it. So they gave me that latitude. They entrusted me. I don't know if all other carvers would have been given that same privilege, but I was. And, you know, I'm still here, so I guess I did an okay job. But again, it wasn't myself. Okay, I had assistants that worked with me, and they deserve the credit of their accomplishments also. So it wasn't just me solely. Again, and with my elders guiding me, and my ancestors. You can ask my assistants. Many times I'd come in the mornings and I'd have a couple of erasers in my hands and they'd go, "You had a visit last night." Yep. Someone knocked on my door and said, "Young man, you don't know what you're doing. You better change what you've got going." And so, yeah, but it turned out. I'm proud of the accomplishments, but I'm proud of all that were involved. They did a great job.
Thank you. Earlier, I mentioned how I heard you three talking about climate change or the change in the weather. How can you describe how things have changed since when you were kids?
There used to be more snow. I mean, we used to be able to jump off the side of the road and get lost in the snow. And used to have snow up to my window, which is about 6 feet. But we haven't had snow in 3 years, not even a foot in my front yard, you know. And I was talking a little earlier about a caterpillar in July.
January.
I'm January. Playing with my dog down in the park down there, and then I saw this gray thing crawling across. I said, "What the heck? What's this thing doing here?" I mean, so I took a picture of it, and I showed a few people, and the world's changing. I mean, when thinking was last year before, it sunshine so hard here, it scared me, because if we had a fire, if there was a fire, it would have been devastating. I mean, it was so dry here, and the rivers dried up, and there was salmon that was at the mouth of the river. And they weren't going anywhere. They were there. They were going to just die there. And a couple of years ago, we didn't even have any snow on the mountains. And we were worried about the rivers that were going to be dry because there wasn't any runoff, you know. And then one year, I don't forget how many, but 6-7 years ago, there was so much snow here that we had to call off the deer hunting because there's so much big winter kill, you know. So, and the salmon is just, let's hope that not being affected by it.
Yeah, and that must affect you too as a fisherman. Oh, yeah. Seeing those salmon. Oh, yeah. Not be able to get up the streams.
I've been fishing since I was 11, and last year was the worst I've ever done in my life. I mean did good for my taxes because I paid a lot of estimated taxes. Got them back. Yeah, it's changed. I mean, there's a big change in this. I mean, us as kids, it was a blast in the winter, and you know, right now the kids going sledding on Hill Street or can't do it now because too many cars, but still, we used to be able to go there all the time, go slide down Hill Street and Warren's Hill. Right. Second Street.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about ice skating on the Cannery Pond, and I said that I'm always nervous about taking the kids out there because it never seems like it's frozen solid enough these days.
Yeah, we used to ice skate there every year. Build a bonfire on the little island and go skating there. And there was a deep part and there was a shallow part. We all tried to stay on the shallow part. But sometimes you get crazy.
Well, I wish we had hours and hours. I could talk to you three forever and hear more stories. But we are running out of time. But I thought before we go out, I was wondering if I could go around the table and have each of you sort of share your hopes for the future of Huna, what you'd like to see in future generations. Mr. G, can we start with you?
I would love to see opportunities for our young people, whatever they may be. And again, as a teacher, I couldn't tell any student what they were going to do in the future. It's up to them to make their mind up. But I want to see the opportunities so that they can come back. I think it's great for them, like Frank and I both left thinking that we were already at the end of the world and we wanted to go somewhere else and found out that really we were at the beginning of the good spot in the world to be and came back. But I would like to see our young people have an opportunity to come back and do what they want to do for the future and carry on our way of life, our Tlingit way of life, which I think is extremely important.
Mary Beth Moss, what would you like to see for the future?
A strong connection to homeland. Frank mentioned that the Huna Tlingit identity depends on Glacier Bay, and I would say that Glacier Bay's identity also depends on the Huna Tlingit being a part of Glacier Bay. So I hope there will always be a strong connection between the people of Huna and their traditional homeland in Glacier Bay.
And Frank Wright.
I think that, future, I always speak for our children, and that's what I think my purpose in Huna is for the children. And, right now the opportunity for them to build a good work ethic and stuff because of Ice Strait Point, is a good thing. Because of fishing, I think there's only three of us left that do long lining and purse seine. So it's kind of hard for me to hire when they don't have the experience, but for the young children to be able to work is a good work ethic, but they also need to be able to identify themselves as who they really are, be proud and say, I am Tlingit. I'm Tlingit, and I'm from Huna. So when they say that and they walk with pride and stuff, because when we were kids, we weren't able to say if we were proud or not because we didn't know. But for the young people, I think that they need that. And Huna's moving along. I mean, you look at it, it's very moving along very fast. And I'm not sure where it's going to go, but I'm hoping for the best.
Goodness sheesh. That's the voice of Frank Wright, president of the board of directors of the Huna Indian Association of Fishermen. We've also been speaking with Mary Beth Moss. She's a National Park Service tribal liaison to the Huna Indian Association. Will you help me again with that, Mary Beth Moss?
You got it right. Yeah.
Yay. All right. And also Gordon Greenwald, master carver, longtime school teacher, among other things, caretaker of Regalia. It's been an honor speaking with the three of you. Thank you again for spending time with us and allowing us to be here.
Thank you.
Goodness, geez.